Who? Me? What? Oh. I guess I better come up with some stuff to say. Hey, y'all. How's it going? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I got coffee, but it's cold. And not because it's iced coffee, but just because I let it get cold. I don't know if it's going to really do the job. Well, it started out too hot, so I couldn't drink it then. I'm going to burn my mouth. But then I forgot about it, so it got too cold. Here I am. Oh, well, coffee or not, Will Gregg's going to be on the show today. Yay! The great thing about interviewing Will Gregg is I'm happy to just turn my mic off and let him talk. The only drawback then is I sometimes forget to turn it back on again when it's my turn. But that guy is so brilliant. The thing of him is, he's got this gigantic education as far as especially history. So he has every metaphor, every example, every analogy from history that you never even heard of, but he just rules at it. And not in a way that is annoying like Dennis Miller making references that you have no idea what the hell he's talking about in a how annoying and obnoxious way. But no, he teaches you something every time. He's brilliant. And not only that, but he's got the vocabulary of Shakespeare. And so, man, and he doesn't stutter, he doesn't, not too bad anyway. And he's good on everything. Especially the coppers. And so, Will Gregg is going to be on again to talk about, well, the rights of man. And the individual's relationship to the state. And its enforcers, and he's going to have a lot of great things to say, and I'm going to have a few topics for him as well. So, yeah, man, listen up. Will Gregg is going to be on the show, and that is a hell of a good thing. Also, Michael Meharry from the 10th Amendment Center is going to join us today, because today is the day we fight back. Hey, what's up, compressor? You're supposed to compress stuff when I yell like that. Didn't seem to compress that very much, did it, folks? Maybe I should turn my knob to the right a little bit. Not turned enough. Today is the day we fight back. So what it is a whole bunch of organizations. Hey, I got the link here. The Electronic Frontier Foundation. You had me at Electronic Frontier Foundation. Okay, the daywefightback.org, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Demand Progress, the ACLU, Reddit, Credo Action, I don't know what that is, Fight for the Future, I don't know what that is, Greenpeace, Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, Boing Boing, the Freedom of the Press Foundation, the Campaign for Liberty, very good, the Libertarian Party, Mozilla, Daily Kos, I'm not going to go through them all here, but there's DuckDuckGo and Tumblr, and Upworthy, and so what we see here is a left, well, I don't see right-wingers. Are there right-wingers here? Wait, there is one right-wing organization taking part in this, right? Freedom Works is part of this, I believe, aren't they? And Freedom Works, I mean, I think they're more libertarian than they were, but that's still, they count as the right, I think. Although I don't see their logo here, but I could have sworn that I had heard that they were going to be a part of this. Anyway, I'm going to go ahead and call it this anyway, because this is what we're aiming toward here. The Left-Right Libertarian Alliance. The new realignment. No longer will the conservative Democrat, liberal Republican, Barack Obama, John McCain, extremist, centrist consensus lead our society. No, now it will be the libertarian consensus. Among the people, the left and the right, among the people. And what we all have in common is we are all opposed to the very worst things our government is doing together. We oppose their spying on us. We oppose their torture. We oppose their jailing people without trial. We oppose their starting wars, backing dictators and revolutions alike. around the world and all of that. It's an end to the empire that we want and a restoration of our Bill of Rights with the purest libertarians as the very moderate middle. I mean, we're radical. I'm not saying we're not radical. I'm just saying we're the ones who want to stop doing horrible things to you. So that's not so extreme, is it? No, it's the people who've gotten away with calling themselves moderate so far, those who agree that they're for everything, all the warfare, all the welfare, all the regulation, all of the total homeland security state. But they're the extremists. And there's a new left-right libertarian realignment coming down the pike. And here, for example, thedaywefightback.org. Last summer, for example, when the American people stopped the war. It wasn't the left-wing anti-war movement out protesting in the streets, was it? The hard left, they all kind of lost their energy and organization when Obama came to power. No, it was the great silent majority. It was the consensus among all the people who don't live in Washington, D.C. that, no, you don't. We don't want a war in Syria. You stop right there. And won. I mean, I wish I could take credit or something, but it was just, this was the sentiment around every kitchen table was, I don't want any more of these damn wars. Well, same thing here with the NSA spying. Norman Solomon has a new piece saying, man, we better not get used to this NSA spying and get desensitized to this NSA spying as all these revelations come out. We better take the opportunity to fight back. Well, today is, they're calling it the day. Today is one day where there's a lot of fighting back going on. All of these groups, and what they all have in common is encouraging people to do whatever they can to exercise whatever political influence they can as an individual, as a business, as some nonprofit group, Iowans for Peace, or whoever you are, whatever you are, to come together to support this thing and to hassle Congress, to let them know, to email them, to call them. And what we'll be talking about, of course, with Michael Meharry from the 10th Amendment Center today is what can be done and who maybe you ought to be hassling. And I mean hassling in a good way, in a Jeffersonian democracy kind of way. Your state representatives, other officials, in order to get them to help to nullify and obstruct this unconstitutional national surveillance state that they have erected. So that Edward Snowden and Glenn Greenwald, etc., have exposed. So today's the day we fight back, if you haven't already. And listen, you know me, man. I'm a plumbline libertarian, and I'm not much into democracy and whatever, but I do live here. And I do know that calls to congressmen sometimes mean something. It's not everything, but it can be. You know, Alan Grayson was asked, geez, how can you go against AIPAC on the Syria war, Alan Grayson? You're Alan Grayson. And Alan Grayson said, hey, AIPAC is one thing, but when the American people make their voice heard, forget it. AIPAC is nothing compared to the people of America. When there's consensus like that, well, you know what? That's the same thing as the power of the people versus the power of this state. You know, no one in power wants to cross the NSA. The NSA's got dirt on them all and whatever. But if there's a consensus among 300 million Americans that we will tolerate nothing less than the complete and total elimination of all of this, then they're going to have to do something. And in fact, the more stern we are about it, the harsher we are, and the more, I want to say radical, but just, you know, principled position we take in favor of the Bill of Rights and keeping all of it, then the better off we are in the long run, too, like the commie dialectic. You know, we got to bring them far, as far as we can. We don't want a little bit of rollback. We want a lot. Demand total liberty. You might get to keep some. And when you can make the phones ring off the hook and make, just forget it. Damn it, never mind the snow. Nobody can get anything done in Congress today because of the endless torrent of faxes and telegrams and emails and ringing telephones on the subject of we want the NSA rolled back and right now. Then I'm not saying it's, you know, a cure-all, but it can really help move things forward. It can really help. It can even really help to change the narrative on TV, although that's a lot bigger road to hoe, of course. But anyway, so Michael Meharry, he's going to be on the show. That was my introduction for Michael Meharry's going to be on the show later today. And also, hey, Marjorie Cohen, she's formerly the, president, chairman, whatever it is, of the CCR, right? The Center for Constitutional Rights? National Lawyers Guild, pardon me. Anyway, and so now she's at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego there, Santa Clara University. And I'm going to be talking with her about this leak. What leak? They just announced it. Like, it was a big deal. Handed the story right to the AP that, yes, they're considering assassinating another American citizen with a drone. And what are you going to do about it? Yeah, that's what I thought. I think something like that was a direct quote of Obama there. Anyway, so we're going to be talking about the unlimited power of the American Emperor with Marjorie Cohen on the show today as well. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. What was the only interest group in D.C. pushing war with Syria last summer? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. What's the only interest group in D.C. pushing to sabotage the nuclear deal with Iran right now? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. Why doesn't the president force an end to the occupation of Palestine, a leading cause of terrorist attacks against the United States? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. The Council for the National Interest is pushing back, putting America first and educating the people about what's really at stake in the Middle East. Help support their important work at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Man, I'm sorry if I sound a little bit out of it. I should be on my second or third Dr. Pepper by now, and I'm behind on my sugar and caffeine regimen. I think I stayed up late last night. Oh, yeah, I did. I was watching that movie about the military commission trial of the people that murdered Abraham Lincoln and the innocent lady that owned the tavern. And yeah, anyway. Free on the Pirate Bay. Will Gregg, Michael Meharry, and Marjorie Cohen coming up on the show for you here in just a few. By the way, I'm giving a speech this Saturday at the Grand Hyatt Hotel in Washington, D.C., and that's the International Students for Liberty Conference, and there's going to be a whole gigantic ton of libertarians and others. Speaking of left-right libertarian realignment, it's happening at the International Students for Liberty Conference this weekend in Washington, D.C., and on Saturday. Oh, by the way, Jeremy Scahill's going to be there, and Oliver Stone, and Stephen Kinzer, who, man, that guy gives great speeches. This one will be about the Dulles brothers, which is one of the most important topics of, you know, modern American history there. But also, I've just seen him give a speech before about the history of America messing around with Iran and Cuba, and it was just brilliant. That guy's just great at giving speeches, man. Believe it. That's worth your $50 to watch Kinzer talk for half an hour. And then also the heroic Robert Higgs is going to be there. And I'm leaving out a bunch of people. And that's just the Future Freedom Foundation part of the conference. That's just the conference within the conference, sponsored by the Future Freedom Foundation. You can find out all about that at fff.org. But if you go look up the International Students for Liberty, there's a whole thing going on, man. I don't know if anybody's coming to my talk because I don't know who's going on in the other room. You know, but it's going to be a huge thing. It's going to be great. I'm looking forward to meeting you guys there, and I'm looking forward to hanging out with Gareth Porter again and hopefully meeting Michael Swanson and, you know, I don't know who else is going to show up. I made some friends in D.C., so, you know, should be cool. Come on out. That's this Saturday. I believe John Glazer and I, the talk that we're putting on will be in the afternoon sometime on Saturday. It's a talk on the subject of libertarianism versus the empire. So I'll be focusing I'll be giving a 15-minute summary of the Empire and the Terror War, I guess, more or less. And then John Glazer will be talking about why anti-imperialism is the center of libertarianism, the most important issue, and why it matters so much that young libertarians keep foreign policy at the forefront. So that's going to be awesome, and so come on out, and then you'll be able also to, I'm not sure if this is happening, but I'm going to try to make it happen if it's not already happening, is I want to have Gareth Porter hawking his book there. And if for some reason that's against the rules, then I'm going to help him, you know, sell him out of the trunk of his car or something. But I want everybody to buy Gareth Porter's great book, Manufactured Crisis, about Iran's nuclear program, and help make that thing a real big deal, especially right now, debunking all of the bogus canards about Iran's nuclear program in the middle of all the controversy, whether we're going to get the final nuclear deal or not and all of that. So that's, you know, really important to me that Gareth shows up with a big box of books and that they get spread to the winds there. All right. So anyway, see you Saturday. I mean, if you're anywhere, you know, within reach of Washington, D.C., then cool. And man, so I get to see snow, right? You know, Virginia, Maryland, that might as well be New England to me. I'm a Texan, so you guys are all a bunch of damn Yankees. Virginia, that's way up there in Yankee Town. Weren't you guys the leaders of the North during the Civil War? No. Snow! I'm so excited. Everybody up there probably hates snow by now, but not me, because I'm not up there. I'm here. A couple of snowflakes, they don't even stick to the ground, and I got a grin from ear to ear, man. I'm a Texan. And not from Dallas either. In Dallas, it always snows a little bit every couple of years at least, you know. But down here in Austin, not so much. All right. So, see you Saturday. Okay, now, yeah, Marjorie Cohen's going to be on about Obama. Just bragging to the paper that, yeah, I can kill American citizens if I feel like it. I mean, he does have to feel like it, though, right? I mean, give him that. There is a check and balance. The president has to, you know, pat his tummy and ask himself, do I feel like murdering this American citizen to death? Yes, I do feel like it. And then his check is balanced and he can murder whoever he wants. No, really. That's the law. Something like that. Anyway, Marjorie Cohen will be on to help clarify later on in the show. Okay, and then, man, so I got a bunch of news to cover. Let's see if I can cover it before time runs out for me to, and I gotta get everybody lined up on the show. Oh, here's an important thing, and maybe we can talk about Marjorie Cohen, talk about this with Marjorie. You know what, I'm gonna skip this, and I'm gonna put this in the Marjorie Cohen category, because it's important and along the lines of her expertise. Okay, here's something that's, important. I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to finish it, but it's our friend Roy Guttman, who, you know, he's a bit on the hawkish side for a reporter that I like, but I like him. And he wrote, Tales by Ex-Detainees Raise Questions About Extremist Goals in Syria. Yeah, no, these aren't nice guys. The ones that America's backing there. And it's amazing how that just gets lost, kind of, in the details. That, yeah, it's America's policy to push regime change in Syria. Obama announced years ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago now, almost, well, two and a half, I guess, that Assad must step down. He must step aside. John Kerry still maintains that position as recently as last week in Geneva. That there's nothing to talk about here until the current dictator resigns. Yeah, right. And so the war rages on. Man, I have trouble saying W and then R words sometimes. The war rages on, and it's America and Saudi Arabia and Turkey and Qatar and Jordan, and to whatever degree the Israelis, you know, they're certainly, you know, helping push the policy. If they're, I don't know to what degree they're actually, you know, participating in it. I wouldn't doubt if they are participating in it very much, but it's certainly, you know, NATO and our GCC allies in conspiracy to overthrow the Baathist regime in Syria. Same old plan. Not that they have an answer to what things are supposed to look like that makes any sense. you know, about any plans that make sense about what it's supposed to look like when the war is over. But anyway, keep them fighting. And the same time that John Kerry is saying, yeah, Al-Qaeda in Syria is getting to be a real problem, we read that, yeah, Congress just sent them a whole bunch more weapons. And then we have to be treated to the spectacle of American State Department weenies begging Al-Qaeda suicide bombers to please bring back the guns you stole. When they sacked the warehouse of the sock puppet Free Syrian Army Brigade, you know, a bunch of expats been living in Virginia the last 20 years, doing no fighting, sitting around at the warehouse collecting their welfare check. Well, they got all ran off. And the ISIS and al-Nusra guys ran off with all the weapons. And then the Americans are asking nicely to please bring them back. You know, Roy's last article before this was, well, maybe with the Islamic Front and al-Nusra working together against ISIS, that'll help solidify the rebellion, huh? Somehow after ISIS is wiped out, I guess. Then the Islamic Front and al-Nusra will have more in common at the end. Yeah. So there's three al-Qaedas, and the Americans are trying mightily to back the least radical of them. And yet, as Roy's colleague Mitchell Prothrow explained on the show, there is no ideological difference or even really, you know, long-term, medium or long-term planning difference. Strategic difference between the three al-Qaedas, the Islamic Front, al-Nusra, or ISIS. The only difference is the leaders. And they don't like each other, and they have maybe different tactics and different short-term goals about which suburb they want to take over first or whatever. Some want to, you know, consolidate their gains, some want to move on, whatever. But in other words, they're not arguing really about policy, but just about who's who and whose jihadi army gets to be the leaders of the other jihadi armies. And, you know, again, these are would have been called the absolute worst of the worst fringe of the Sunni-based insurgency from the Iraq War, the most recent one. Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the guys who blow up marketplaces full of women and children, you know, just for the reaction in you. And that's America's policy. Nobody seems to call them out. Nobody seems to say, hey, you know, if you guys have to intervene over there, why aren't you backing the people who are fighting Al-Qaeda? George W. Bush, I'm not saying this is okay, I'm a non-interventionist, but George W. Bush used to pay Bashar al-Assad, and Bill Clinton before him, used to pay Bashar al-Assad to torture and murder Al-Qaeda guys. So what's this? And of course, you know, the neocons didn't want that. The neocons wanted regime change in Syria and in Iran right away. Now, it didn't matter that their plan for what Iraq was supposed to look like after the regime change there didn't come about, didn't seem to dissuade them at all. They didn't learn a thing from that. Well, we just keep blowing up stuff and eventually it'll work out. We just have to turn the Middle East into a boiling cauldron. That's what Michael Ledeen said. Yeah, we'll just turn it into a boiling cauldron. And then, you know, however it comes out, it'll be worse than it is now. And that's what we want. So we'll just make that our official policy, I guess. All right. That's interesting. All right. And then so now, oh, man, I'm about to have to go. Let me tell you this. Yosef Butt has been writing in the National Interest. He's got one called No Iran Deal. No problem about how, man, they're not even making nuclear weapons. And in fact, he's got one at armscontrollaw.com, Joiner's blog, debunking some myths. And Yosef Butt, man, he's about the best we've got on the Iran nuclear issue now. Check him out at the National Interest. And I'll have him back on the show next month sometime for you. All right, we'll be right back with the great Will Grigg here in just a sec. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe, and tell them Scott sent you. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. And you know what? Is that two Descendants intros in a row? I might not have thought through which bumper music I was lining up there. I'll have to check that. Oh, no, one was Jodie Foster's Army, which I would gladly join. Anyway, Will Grigg is on the line, the heroic Will Grigg, author of the great blog Pro Libertate at freedominourtime.blogspot.com, freedominourtime.blogspot.com, and his book is called Liberty in Eclipse, out soon in audiobook, or maybe already. Anyway, welcome to the show. How are you doing, Will?
Scott, it's always great to be with you. Thank you so much.
Good times. Very happy to have you on here. Let me ask you, are there any trends in policing recently in America that you would like to comment on?
I think that there are a number of trends that are eminently worthy of comment, the most disturbing of which is to treat the presence of a firearm in a home that is targeted for an investigation as justification for a no-knock SWAT raid. That's a really troubling trend because this partakes of the same sensibility I contend that leads to such things as hit strikes in countries like Afghanistan or even drone strikes overseas.
I'm sorry, your phone cut out a little bit there right before Pakistan.
Oh, what's happening in countries like Pakistan and Afghanistan is that when you have a certain number of hits in a threat matrix, then the targeted dwelling of the targeted individuals and everybody around them are considered to be fair game. Mm-hmm. For drone strikes or hit teams or other ways of disposing of those targets with extreme prejudice. We've not quite reached that state here in the United States, but every SWAT team has something they call a threat matrix, which I consider to be broadly or distantly kindred to the disposition matrix, which is the term used to describe this industrialized killing apparatus that is run by the NSA and the Pentagon and the CIA. Mm-hmm. And in the threat matrix, there's a weighting of various factors that are taken into account on the basis of intelligence regarding a targeted individual or a targeted dwelling. And one of the things that weighs most heavily, is the identified confirmed presence of a firearm, a legally owned firearm, within that dwelling. If there's a legal gun owner at an address and the cops are thinking of a narcotics investigation, or even as was recently the case just outside of Des Moines, Iowa, this incident involving an investigation of credit card fraud, then this is used as justification for saddling up and getting everybody kitted out in their paramilitary drag and then conducting a no-knock raid that involves a battering ram rather than a knock and announce. And this is going to get people killed. Indeed, it's gotten people killed before, and one such incident occurred in Texas last December 19th when a deputy by the name of Adam Sowers was killed as part of a team invading the home of Henry McGee. He was, on the basis of an informant once again, identified as somebody who was growing marijuana in his home. And this occurred before dawn. At about 5:50 in the morning, you had this band of armed marauders break into this man's home. And so he did what he was trained by instinct to do and what he had the legal right to do, which was to grab his legally owned firearm and shoot the first assailant who presented himself, who just happened to be Deputy Sowers. In this case, the grand jury in Burleson County no-billed Mr. McGee. He still stands to be prosecuted for possession of a plant that the government doesn't like at this juncture in our history. But he had originally been charged with capital murder for defending himself against somebody who didn't identify himself as a police officer. And quite frankly, even if he had, really had no business conducting a pre-dawn raid on the basis of information that there was an illicit substance within the home. But the reason why the raid was staged the way it was, if you take a look at the warrant, take a look at the history of such raids in Texas and elsewhere, it's because there was intelligence that Mr. McGee was a gun owner, that he had legally owned firearms in his domicile. And this is treated within this threat matrix as good and sufficient justification for staging SWAT raids, including no-knock raids. I do think that it's a tragedy that Deputy Sowers was killed. He really shouldn't have been where he was doing what he was doing. He should not have been killed, but his death was not the fault of the man who killed him. The man who killed him was exercising his moral and legal right to defend himself, his property, and his pregnant girlfriend against an unidentified intruder who was a trespasser on his property, and that's why the grand jury there in Burleson County no-billed him. Now, that contrasts rather sharply with a rather similar case from 2006 involving a man named John Quinn who lived in McKinley, Texas. And once again, on the basis of informants who were cooperating in order to get a downward departure on their sentences, it turns out neither of them was actually prosecuted in exchange for providing this information about Mr. Quinn's son, his adult son, Brian. There was a post-midnight no-knock raid on Mr. Quinn's home. And in the warrant, it said that this was necessary because, once again, there were firearms on the premises. That's something that they've been told by their informants. And so they used a battering ram, busted down the front door. Mr. Quinn grabbed his gun and went to the front door to find out what was going on. And he was shot by a deputy whose last name was Guerrero. And in this case, was the defender who was charged with aggravated assault on a police officer, in spite of the fact that he was the one who was injured, and the individual who tried to kill him was no-billed by a grand jury. That was in 2008, if memory serves. Mr. Quinn was eventually acquitted of the charge of aggravated assault. He was found guilty of possession of less than a gram of cocaine, which was found in a part of the home that was not subject to search, and according to the terms of the warrant. It was considered a legitimate search because they had staged a no-knock raid and there was active resistance to that raid. And so there's an active challenge before the Supreme Court now that's been filed on behalf of Mr. Quinn on the basis of the fact that the Fourth Amendment here, as read in what I consider to be a deranged opinion by the District Court of Appeals there in Texas, the Fourth Amendment supposedly authorizes the use of this kind of tactic anytime there is a reasonable expectation that somebody in the domicile has a firearm. And so if they develop intelligence, and it's not hard to do in this country, particularly in states like Texas or Idaho for that matter, if they develop intelligence that somebody in that domicile has a weapon, then they essentially can lay siege to that home in military fashion. And if they meet any kind of resistance at all, that supposedly releases all considerations that might limit what they can do, where they can search, and what they might find. I should point out, in the case of John Quinn, his son, who had no self-interested reason to do so, said that his father never took his drugs, that he was trying to hide cocaine from his son in order to cure him of his drug addiction. Medical examination after Mr. Quinn was taken to the hospital subsequent to being shot confirmed that he had no drugs in his system. But he was found guilty of a misdemeanor of possessing less than, I think it was half of a gram of cocaine, and he was given a $500 fine and 2 years probation. And that was the fruits of this paramilitary raid on this man's home in Texas. I just found it striking that you have these two rather similar cases, one less tragic than the other because obviously the case of Mr. Quinn didn't involve a death, and the death of Adam Sowers is a tragedy by any definition. But I do think that the latter of those two examples, that of Henry McGee and Adam Sowers, does show a rather encouraging trend on the part of the juries, the grand juries here at least, in that at least they were able to examine Mr. McGee's self-defense claim on the merits and on the law and decide that in spite of the fact that he was a mundane rather than a member of the state's exalted enforcement caste, that he does have the right to defend himself when he's dealing with unidentified intruders before dawn in his own home. So that's grounds for some highly qualified optimism, I believe. And that sort of underscores something that Lysander Spooner was writing about back in the mid-19th century. He talked about the right to resistance, how the whole purpose of having a constitutionally protected right to keep and bear arms was to use those arms at a time of our choosing to protect ourselves against the criminal aggression of the government, and that he confided in the ability of citizens acting as jurors to vindicate that right when a citizen defended himself against corruption or aggression on the part of what he called bandits or ruffians. And he was using that expression to describe state officials who were acting in defiance of the law. And unfortunately, such defiance of law on the part of law enforcement agencies has become epidemic in our country. And I think that we're starting to see just the beginnings, the premonitory tremors, if you will, of active resistance to that on the part of the public. And I think perhaps the perfectly hideous outcome of the Kelly Thomas trial in Orange County, California, has, if you will, sort of stimulated a histaminic reaction on the part of the body politic. I think finally our allergy to tyranny, or perhaps a better example or better parallel, be the gag reflex, has been triggered on the part of that section of the public that retains some respect for the principle of self-ownership and the idea of the rule of law. I'd like to think that's the case. It's badly overdue if that is the case.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was one of the things I was going to ask you was, you know, about the pushback. And I think people, I agree with you that it is sort of becoming common knowledge now that, well, it's like we're all black folks now is basically what you're talking about here. Is this is how it's always been for, you know, the darker your skin, the more likely you are to be tortured by the local deputy sheriffs. But now it's just everybody, because there's no accountability whatsoever. They can do this to a millionaire. They could do this to somebody, you know, whose ancestors came off the Mayflower or whatever they want. Nobody could stop them. They can. A deputy sheriff has more rights than a billionaire now in America. All government employees do, and there's no accountability whatsoever. And so it's starting to, you know, now it's the nice side of town where this stuff is starting to happen, which means it's starting to get more attention from people who at least imagine they might be able to do something about it. Like, it seems obvious that you could pass a very common sense, never mind libertarian, but just a very common sense law in any state in the union that says, oh, no, actually, you can only use a SWAT team if there's a real reason to believe that there's armed and dangerous, you know, felon, somebody's willing to shoot it out with you. Otherwise, you cannot do that. And you're going to have to, you know, really explain, you know, why it is that you could expect that. None of this nonsense about, well, hey, if he's an American with a gun, of course he would shoot if he's being raided, so they have to raid him.
That seems to be sort of the way that the defenders of this bootstrap the argument. They'll commit an act of undisguised paramilitary aggression against somebody who's suspected of a nonviolent offense, and then precipitate some kind of a tragedy and say that the tragedy that was brought about by their own actions retroactively validates what they had done. That's actually the way that the so-called law regarding resisting works here in the state of Idaho. There was a decision back in, I believe, 2008, Lusby versus Idaho, in which a police officer basically bullied his way into the home of a single woman, and she resisted him at the doorstep, saying, you don't have a warrant, you don't have probable cause, you're not permitted into this house. He shoved her aside and then said that her act of resistance was a crime, and then arrested her on the basis of finding a marijuana pipe or some such trivial object in her home. And this went all the way to the state Supreme Court in 2008, and the state Supreme Court ruling here in Idaho said that the act of resistance to this illegal search by a police officer retroactively justified the search. That's the sort of thing that's engendering the pushback that we're starting to see, and I hope that it will prosper and thrive.
Yeah, me too. All right, I'm sorry, we got to take this break. Hold it right there. I hate to interrupt you. I know I probably just, you were done. But anyway, we'll be right back with the great Will Grigg on the Scott Horton Show right after this. Hey, y'all, Scott here. So you made a little bit of money in this horrid economy, only to find that the Fed has more or less outlawed saving. So into the treacherous waters of the stock market bubble you go. But how to make a little money without too much risk of losing it all? Check out WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who opens a very real window into his main account, updating his subscribers on the facts of and the reasoning behind all his market moves. Follow along on paper or with real money and see what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org is the website. Keep all my interview archives there. And the whole show archives and my blog and the chat room and everything there. ScottHorton.org. Also, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /ScottHortonShow. Now, we're talking with the great Will Grigg, chronicler of America's police state at Pro Libertate. That's freedominourtime.blogspot.com. freedominourtime.blogspot.com. And we're talking about the SWAT raid and the threat matrix. And now this is something, when you were first talking about, you know, this new policy where if the warrant is to be served on any home where the cops think there might be a gun, and I don't guess this is completely universal across, you know, all 18,000 counties in America or whatever, but probably soon enough anyway. If there's any reason to believe that there's perfectly lawful gun ownership going on, that automatically guarantees a SWAT team, or at least, you know, is a big counter on their threat matrix. You get, you know, +2 yeah. for having a rifle on their threat matrix thing. And it reminded me of what we all read of Greenwald and Scahill in their first piece for The Intercept about the and of course Gareth Porter's great work on the Delta Force raids in Afghanistan for Truth Out before that, about in Iraq too, about how they just use their cell phone data in order to come up with you know, and then maybe one other kind of also vague signals intelligence in order to murder somebody with a drone when we're talking about overseas. Same point being that the decision, quote unquote, is made by the computer. So all you're doing is putting a check mark in the box. Is he exactly above the age of 14 and below the age of 70? Yeah. Does he have a rifle? Yeah. Is he a pashtun? Yeah. Okay, then he scores a 60, kill him. And so, right, that's the way they do it there. Same thing here. The decision is already, it's like if you work at Subway or whatever, the instructions on exactly how many pepperonis you're supposed to have or whatever. There's no discretion involved. You're just supposed to do it exactly along the formula. And so basically, the adult decision-making process of, well, you know, I could see how you might want to do a SWAT raid, but in this case, I don't know, there are children's toys all over the front yard, so maybe we want to be careful. Or, I just don't feel like murdering anybody this week, so let's wait until he goes to the Quickie Mart for a pack of cigarettes and then pull him over on the side of the road instead, or something like that. All of those kind of, you know, human adult decision-making processes are left out, and the decision-making is turned over to this automated function, and therefore the responsibility is turned over to the automated function, too. And so, first, they have no comment because there's an internal investigation. And then at the end of the internal investigation, they say they did everything according to the book, just in the proper procedure. So therefore, it was perfectly moral, too, is all you need to know, right?
As long as they have some template that will produce that type of a result and they can certify the proper procedures have been followed, they consider this to be a good and sufficient justification of anything that was done, no matter how abhorrent or no matter how obvious it is that innocent people ended up being hurt or killed. And the purpose of this is to give those who carry out these raids a colorable excuse here that will make them qualify for what is called selective immunity or functional immunity. There are all kinds of different forms of immunity. Qualified immunity is usually invoked any time a police officer does something that would be prosecuted as a crime if it were done by somebody not accoutred in the state's formal garb. And I do think that you hit it on the nose, Scott, when you talked about the fact that there is this standard approach, this ritual of self-justification that starts with deferring public comment until the procedures have been investigated and that the internal review has taken place. Then afterwards, when they've consummated this familiar ritual, they say the procedures were followed. We have nothing more to say about this. The decision's been made. We're not going to relitigate that issue. We have to move on from here. A really good example of this in a very minor way just happened a few days ago in a little town here in Idaho called Filer. It's about 2,000 people, 2,2500 in population. It's between two towns with police agencies, one of which is the county seat with the sheriff's office. It's 8 miles away from the sheriff's office. They don't need a police department. There are five members of this police department whose function it is to collect revenue, primarily by enforcing municipal codes. That's the only reason they have a police department. They got a complaint about dogs at large on Saturday afternoon, and a police officer rolls up. The dogs are in the on the front lawn of the house in question. The dogs come up and start to approach him because he's a police officer, and, of course, he emits this dense musk of fear. That's what police officers do. That's their distinctive aroma. So he gets out of the car, and the first thing he does is kick at one of them, who's a Labrador. Labradors are not noted for their aggression. 20 seconds later, the dog is dead. The dog was crouching on the front yard of this man's home. He shot the dog about 5 feet away from the house, specifically a bedroom where a 9-year-old child, it's not a bedroom, I think it's the living room, where the 9-year-old child was having a birthday party with a bunch of his friends. Now, if any other person, somebody who is not a member of the state's enforcement class, had done this, this would have been considered a felonious act of reckless endangerment using a firearm. And under Idaho State Code, I believe it's 18-37, that's a felony for which the person would be liable for a 15-year prison term. But within a few minutes of this happening, the police chief there in Filer signed off on it, saying he followed proper procedures. As far as I'm concerned, he did everything that needed to be done the way it should have been done. And the thing that really aggravates me about this, if you watch the video, and I posted an item about this on the Lou Rockwell blog early this morning. If you watch the video, you never see the encounter between this man and the dog's owner. But the police officer pounded on the door and immediately lit into the owner. And you can hear the panic in that officer's voice. His voice is tremulous. He's completely lost all control. And he is threatening to take the man away, arrest him for resist and obstruct because the man refused to provide his ID, which he's not legally required to provide, by the way, unless he's operating a motor vehicle. A police officer has no right, no authority to demand his ID. But what you don't see is that the man was confined to a wheelchair. He suffers from Parkinson's disease. The dog was his trained companion animal, his trained guide dog and assistance animal. No record of aggression at all whatsoever, and he ends up handing this man a citation, $100 citation to pay for the expense of murdering his dog. If you don't think the word murder applies here, slaughtering his dog perhaps is a better expression. But this is all ratified because it fits the template of procedure. And it's not just dogs that are being killed. I mean, that's a horrible thing, but it's not in any way comparable to the killing of innocent people, including children. You mentioned SWAT raids taking place in homes where there are children's toys strewn in the front yard. That reminds me of the Ayanna Stanley case from several years ago, where you have a SWAT team pursuing a murder suspect. That's a serious crime, but it was a murder suspect they could have apprehended if they had simply staked out the house and waited for him to come out of the dwelling. But they had a camera crew with them from A&E Network, and so Showtime syndrome descended upon them. That's when they wanted to pose and preen for the camera. And many members of the SWAT team...
Showtime being the code name for the ATF's murderous raid on the Branch Davidians.
And that's a big part of this conversation, Scott, is what we're finding here is that time after time, these SWAT raids are being carried out for reasons of propaganda, for reasons of agitation and propaganda, rather than for any tactical reason that will withstand scrutiny. Of course, the whole war on drugs is one immense propaganda exercise. There's nothing that happens that is of any substantive benefit to anybody.
I'm sorry, though. I stopped you from telling the story of what happened in that raid.
Well, in the Ayanna Stanley case, you have a midnight raid that involves a flashbang grenade being thrown into a living room where this little girl, I think 6 or 7 year old girl, was sleeping. She was burned by the flashbang grenade and then shot in the head by the first trooper through the door, who later tried to blame the grandmother, claiming that the grandmother had grabbed the barrel of his gun and somehow forced it to discharge. That's Joseph Weekly, the name of that the trooper that was the first through the door. But there were people who were warning the SWAT team as they're gathering around the house that there were children inside, there were toys scattered in the front yard. Even to somebody of the dubious observational capacity of a police officer, that's a clue that there are probably children inside the dwelling. And they didn't have to do this. They needed to lock down the perimeter here and just wait for the man to come out of the house. It wasn't a hostage situation.
They got away with that one too, didn't they, Will?
Yes, they did. They did because they followed procedures. And that, of course, is the reason why those procedures exist. They're not to serve the benefit of the public. They're to exculpate the people who carry out these killing errands on behalf of the state.
All right, now I'm sorry because we're almost out of time here, and I really want to ask you if I can figure out the right way to phrase it. Do you think that liberals imagine that gun laws will only be applied to the caricature of a Republican voter? Do they think that that's who the war on guns is about and for, is a bunch of upper middle class, you know, small business owners and golfers and whatever? Do they not realize the hand-in-hand nature of the war on guns and the war on drugs, the demonization of gun ownership to the degree where the very same people who they decry as the innocent victims of a drug war gone mad are made that level of victim because of the cops' assertion of probable gun ownership around, you know, legal or illegal?
I think you're describing accurately the tribal myopia of that faction of our political system. And there's complementary nearsightedness on the part of conservatives as well. The difference is that conservatives are a lot more possessive here when it comes to the right to keep and bear arms. I don't know why it is the self-described progressives don't reverse engineer our present circumstances and see that the current enthusiasm for gun control began with an effort to disarm black people in the Bay Area in California in the 1960s who were being abused by the police. Or go back a little bit further and see how the American Indians were disarmed before they were slaughtered and broken.
Well, and the gun rights right needs to recognize just how militarized their gun control cops are because of the drug war they've supported all this time.
Amen.
I'm sorry.
Exactly,
we're
right.
So out of time. Freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Thanks, Will.
Thank you. Take care, Scott.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. I'll tell you what, man, it's times like this when people really show their true political colors, you know? I just went and Googled off now, and up came all these warnings from liberals talking about how if a coalition of leftists, rightists, and libertarians can succeed in rolling back the beyond Orwellian illegal, unconstitutional surveillance state, well, the next thing you know, those terrible right-wingers are going to take away all our welfare. So, therefore, do not work with them in trying to roll back the NSA and their illegal spying. Hilarious. Well, and of course, there are a lot of right-wingers who feel the same way. You know, a lot of right-wingers like to pretend they believe in liberty when Democrats are in power. But then up comes an issue like this. And they have to choose, who do you love more, the military or yourself, you know? And it's hard. It's a hard choice for conservatives a lot of times. But anyway, yeah, the NSA, that's the military. It's good that the totalitarians on the right and the left are showing their true colors, what they're really about and where their priorities are. Because the libertarians, we get to form our new coalition for peace and for liberty with all of the good liberals and good conservatives, leftists and rightists, who get sick and tired of the power mongers and the compromisers and who would like some peace and their Bill of Rights back. And so, congratulations to us. Welcome to the show. It's Michael Meharry from the 10th Amendment Center, offnow.org. How are you doing?
Scott, good to see you. Or not see you, but hear you.
Yeah, well, it's good to hear you, too. I appreciate you joining us on the show today. And I don't mean to be too mean to, you know, rank and files of the left and the right, really, because it's those who actually seek power among the left and the right, who I really have such a problem with and who have such a problem with the liberties that I hold so dear. But I think the average kind of rank and file Democrat or Republican would tend to agree that they would prefer peace and the Bill of Rights, too, if they had a chance at it, you know? What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right. I think that your average man and woman hanging out on the street and doodling around on Google on their computer don't want the federal government spying on them, and that doesn't matter whether they lean toward the political left or the political right. Sounds like you got into the Think Progress article that came out a couple of weeks ago about the opt-out campaign.
Well, and this one is the Crooks and Liars saying, hey, and go and look at this. Crooks and Liars, of course, just mean the Republicans, I guess, not the people who are currently keeping a database of everywhere your cell phone has been for the last 5 years.
Exactly. You know, it's interesting. There was a really good rebuttal to that Think Progress piece written by published in another progressive blog, and I can't remember which one it was. But, you know, they made the point that state action can and has been used by folks on the left to advance their agenda, and it hasn't resulted in the collapse of all that progressives hold dear. And they pointed out the Trust Act out in California, where basically the state authorities are saying, you know what, we're not going to hold these minor criminals so that ICE can come deport them. So, you know, this state-based kind of action works both ways. And
sanctuary cities is what you're talking about there, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And they have the Trust Act that they passed out in California. Basically, the state authorities, you know, it was set up so that if somebody came in and they were deemed to be an illegal, they would hold them regardless of what crime they had committed until the immigration people showed up. And Governor Brown signed the Trust Act into law, and basically, if it's a minor crime, they're going to let them go. They're not waiting for any federal immigration officials to show up. So,
yeah, good deal. Well, yeah, that's an important example. And I'm not sure if this is the same one that you're talking about, because there's been a few good refutations of that Think Progress piece from the left and the right. But there's a good one in Counterpunch where they talk about, hey, look, we're talking about the NSA completely not just violating the Bill of Rights, but they're violating the Patriot Act that they're invoking. You know how I know? The author of it said so. They never intended for a minute to legalize bulk collection of everyone's metadata like this. And Sensenbrenner, the, you know, quote-unquote author of it anyway, it was really the Department of Justice that authored the damn thing.
Right.
He's on board for and has his own, I think, legislation in the U.S. Congress to repeal that part of the Patriot Act that they're, you know, pretending to invoke the color of law here. So we're not talking, this is like, you know, we're talking about nullifying completely illegal, unconstitutional behavior here, not, you know, a public education for minorities or something like
exactly.
In the bad old days of the 1950s.
That's a good point. Anybody who can't see that is either neurotic or else they're lying because they want the power. Because anybody that can't see that this NSA data collection and the extent that it's extending into everybody's life is not a violation of, you know, not just the Constitution, but just basic civil liberties and human dignity. If you can't see that, then I'm really going to worry about you.
And, you know, I think also part of it, too, is, and I'm guilty of this as well, although I try to only shoot up, you know, and give regular people the benefit of the doubt. But it's hard to not assume bad motives among people who you don't know, whose politics you think are just horrible and would lead to whatever horrible consequences. Oh, they just must be horrible, too. And so when a progressive hears a libertarian being really good on a lot of things that leftists and progressives are supposed to be really good on, like, say, the Fourth and the Fifth Amendment, for example, the Eighth, things like that, they can't help but suspect that what are you really up to? Like,
right.
You know, like you're a part of a secret communist cell who is back in the McCarthy era, right? You're only pretending to be a liberal Democrat. You're really trying to create a Bolshevik tyranny here.
Right.
Same sort of suspicion falls on you.
That's true. You do get a lot of that. But, you know, and this has really been a neat thing for me to be able to actually be involved in a transpartisan coalition and actually work shoulder to shoulder with folks that I may not agree with politically on a whole host of issues, but to be able to come together and focus on this issue and to work together in a friendly way, it's really neat, and you find out that some of these people are actually pretty cool. You know, you might not agree with all of their politics, but, you know, you start to realize that there's a lot of people that know, they just want peace. They just want freedom. They just want prosperity for themselves and for their families. And, you know, sometimes there's some misguided ways to go about it, but it's neat being able to connect with people on that level and kind of get away from that, well, you believe this, so you must be this kind of attitude.
Right. Yeah, you know, I remember this poll years ago now, but I bet it's the same result. It was 91% say the Constitution is important to them. And what they really meant by that, and when you're talking about 91%, you're talking about people who are not very political, you know, but what they really meant by that was they're under the impression that that's the last thing holding their government back from wholesale violations of their rights. But that
right.
At least in America, we have the Bill of Rights. We have something like a Matlockian fair trial. Where we have a chance to have our say, and they can't just kick in our door because they feel like it, or drone us because they feel like it, that kind of thing. And so, you know, I mean, and really, you look at it, the only person that I even know of who, you know, public so-called intellectual or bureaucrat or anything, who has outright proposed revamping the Bill of Rights is Cass Sunstein, Samantha Power's husband and cognitive infiltrator, or whatever the hell he calls it. He's the only one who says, hey, we need to rewrite the First Amendment because we need to ban your speech. Nobody is for that. Everyone would at least pretend to agree that the Bill of Rights is sacred. It's the last thing to get rid of when we finally get rid of the national government, right?
Exactly. I mean, it's designed to put restraints around the federal government. And, of course, you know, there's people in the federal government that don't like that very much. And maybe that's the Sunstein case. But, yeah, for those of us
well,
that are out
here, he's the only one who will admit it publicly,
yeah.
Right? No one else
exactly.
will even admit it publicly that they don't like the Bill of Rights because it's in their way, you know?
Exactly.
So.
But, yeah, and, you know, I don't know.
In other words, we should win. Because we're right, and everybody, we have the consensus on our side. First Amendment, yeah, we like that. And the Second, and the, for that matter, the Third, and the rest.
Exactly, and it's true, and that's the thing that we really need to tap into, and I think that's, you know, that's been the failure of a lot of political movements, is that it becomes a movement of political movers and shakers as opposed to a movement of people. And that's one of the things we really want to do with the Off Now campaign, is get your average person involved, get your average person cognizant, get your average person aware of what's going on so that we can tap into that sentiment and use that power that comes from people banding together across the political spectrum to fight something. You know, that's an extremely powerful thing, and we really need to tap into that.
Right. All right, well, when we get back from this break, we'll be talking more with Michael Meharry from the 10th Amendment Center and the Off Now campaign about this day, the February the 11th, the day we fight back, what people are doing. It's a very broad coalition, speaking of the realignment, supporting this thing, and how you can get involved and really help take this short window of opportunity that we have to roll back the National Security Agency and the surveillance state. Offnow.org. We'll be right back after this. Today's show is brought to you in part by Audible.com. You get a free audiobook download at audibletrial.com/Scott. Audible has over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. For Scott Horton Show listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with their free 30-day trial. I personally recommend Dirty Wars by Jeremy Scahill. It's great for anyone wanting the inside story on the cruel and counterproductive terror war of the Obama years. You can sign up for a free 30-day trial and download Dirty Wars at no charge by going to audibletrial.com/Scott. That's audibletrial.com/Scott. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org is my website. ScottHorton.org/chat for chatting. ScottHorton.org/listen for listening. And we got interviews and whole show archives and everything like that. Also, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /ScottHortonShow. And, I should mention, for those of you who listen to the interview podcast only, you should know, in case you don't, that this show is live from 3 to 5 Eastern Time every day on the Liberty Express at libertyexpressradio.com. All right, then. Hey, you know what? We're at Daily Paul Radio, too. Okay, we're talking with Michael Meharry from the 10th Amendment Center, and today is the so-called day we fight back. There's this huge coalition, left, right, and libertarian, at thedaywefightback.org, pushing for what exactly? And are you guys a member of this thing, or just in spirit, or what?
I guess we're a member of it in spirit. It's really a I think a focus to try to get people to call Congress and get those critters up there to do something about the NSA spying. And you know, I'm all for anything that, number one, raises awareness, and I think this has been really effective in that area. I can't go anywhere on Facebook or any place without seeing something about, you know, the day we fight and dealing with the NSA. So I think that's a positive thing. I'm rather skeptical of any type of activity that tries to get Congress to do something, because they're apt to not do something. So we would really want to focus our attention on working at the state and local level. But we're definitely partners in spirit with what's going on, and we stand by the sentiment. You know, we want the NSA spy ended, and whatever can be done to get that done, we're all for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, certainly having this going on in the background sets a nice stage for you when you go and meet with the state officials, and you meaning the people involved in your movement. But so tell me how this works. And, you know, I don't know, don't be dishonest or anything, but tell me how well this is working, how possible, how surprised you are to find out just how possible it is to get a state legislator, maybe not all of them or a majority of them, but some of them, to do what you want and to, you know, introduce this kind of legislation that could help to interdict, to interpose and nullify the federal surveillance state.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm extremely pleased with the progress of the Off Now campaign to this point. When we got together in November and really started putting together the Fourth Amendment Protection Act, which essentially denies any material support from the state to the NSA and can include things like any state entity supplying water or electricity turning it off, and also prohibiting data sharing or the use of shared data in state courts, two very important provisions. When we first started talking about this, we were kind of thinking, if we could get 10 states on board with this movement, that would be pretty positive. That would be pretty good for, you know, something that basically we're putting together here within a 6-month period. At this date, we're at, I believe, 13 states that have introduced some type of Fourth Amendment protection legislation.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, and the biggie, the real biggie, was yesterday. A delegate in Maryland, right there on the NSA doorstep, introduced the Fourth Amendment Protection Act. Actually, he introduced it last Friday late, and we went public with it yesterday. But Maryland, and the cool thing about the Maryland initiative is I talked to this delegate on the phone. His name's Delegate Smiegel, and I was saying, look, you know, realistically, do you think you can move this? And he said, you know what, I think I can at least get it out of committee. And when you get something out of committee, then, you know, who knows what's going to happen. And this guy has a history of working with Democrats on civil libertarian issues. So this is a bill denying material support to the NSA in the NSA's backyard that actually has a good shot at getting some legislative legs. So that's extremely exciting just in and of itself. So, and, you know, the real biggie still hadn't dropped yet. Everybody's waiting for Utah because they've got the data center and they've got that water contract sitting out there. Mm-hmm. And I'll just tell your listeners that Utah is very, very close. It's going to happen. I just can't tell you when because I don't know yet. But Utah is going to happen. So, and I also know of another state. So we're going to have at least
15. Is going to happen, you're saying,
states.
Is going to pass both houses of their legislature?
I'm saying it's going to be introduced.
It's
that's
going
step
to be
one. Get the bill introduced.
Right.
The legislative fight, you know, that's a whole other ball of wax. The success that we've had on that front is the Arizona passed out of its first committee on, I think it was last week. So, you know, we're actually seeing a bill moving forward. So that's the next step. Once the introductions will start slowing down now as we're getting into the legislative sessions, and then we'll start seeing the hearings and the committee votes. And so then we'll start to get a feel of which of these bills are going to actually be able to get some legs and keep moving. And Arizona was the first victory, having a passage out of a committee. Mm. It was 5-2 also, so it wasn't even close.
Now, you know, I'm not one to really ever participate in this kind of politics or, you know, messing around talking with or trying to lobby state or federal representatives or anybody like that. Not that I, you know, advise people not to. It just hasn't really been my thing. But
it's weird.
you know, it occurs to me that as detached as I imagine, say, for example, the Texas state capitol is from my influence. It also, and of course, you know, the NSA has their thing in San Antonio, and the federal government has a lot of influence over the government of the state of Texas, no doubt
sure
about
does.
That. But it doesn't seem, as far as I know, I mean, I guess there are a lot of telecommunications firms and stuff here, but it seems like, you know, maybe the surveillance industrial complex is not so thick here, you know, that it can out-lobby just the regular people and businessmen of Texas who have their own interests in keeping their own matters private and would rather not live in a totalitarian society and that kind of thing. It makes me wonder whether, in other words, what I'm trying to get at is if a bunch of, you know, ideological coalition types came together to really push something like this, would anybody show up to try to stop them? You know what I mean?
Well,
it seems like maybe it's doable.
It is doable. You know, it is. There is some resistance. You do get people that don't like to have their apple cart bumped around, and that happens with any piece of legislation. And having gone through the committee process in Arizona, we're kind of getting a feel for where some of the opposition comes from. And, of course, state law enforcement, they don't like bills like this because, you know, they like getting unconstitutionally gathered data from the federal government so that they can have an investigation. So, you know, you get the police that come in and say, oh, if you do this, there's going to be pedophiles running loose on the streets and all this ridiculous stuff that they come up with. And then we've had some university backlash that...
The NSA had abolished that from our society. That's great news. Thanks for filling me in.
And, you know, we've had some pushback from some universities that, you know, they like getting the NSA funding to do research, and they don't have a problem with selling their souls for some research a dollar, so you get that kind of kickback. But here's the thing. It's a tough sell. Most people don't believe the law enforcement officer when they tell you that, you know, crime's going to run rampant if they can't use unconstitutionally gathered data for the NSA. Most normal people sit there and go, that's bull crap. And so it's a pretty tough sell for these people that are opposing this. And I think the committee vote, even after all these people get up and, you know, they tell their horror stories, it still ended up being a, like I said, I think it was either a 5-2 or a 4-2 vote. It wasn't close. It wasn't contested. So these kind of arguments fall pretty flat. So I think you're right. You know, in a state like Texas, you know, you'll get some pushback. But I think when this comes up, and I do think it will come up in the legislative session next year, I think it's got a good shot of making it through and passing.
Mm-hmm. And again, you know, it's all ultimately, even if every one of these individual initiatives fail, it's all still to the proper end of educating people about, first of all, like you said, what's going on, and secondly, how wrong it is, and thirdly, you know, avenues that can be taken to try again, get it done next time then.
Exactly. I had a conversation with Tom Woods a few weeks ago on his radio show, and, you know, he made the point, and I think this is a really good point. He says, if nothing else, what this does is it gets people to start thinking in a more decentralized way, instead of running to Congress or running to Washington, D.C. with every problem, to start thinking, maybe we can find a solution at the state level. Maybe we can find a solution at the local level. Hey, maybe we can find a solution at the individual level. And to get people thinking more locally and more decentralized and not everything has to be done through this one giant conglomerate in Washington, D.C., and I think that's, you know, from the overall big picture, I think that's very important. I want people to start thinking outside of this giant glob centralization paradigm and start thinking about decentralizing and giving individuals and communities the freedom and the autonomy to make their own decisions.
Right. Okay, so now tell us all about this movement, the group, the organization, the model legislation, how people can join, who they can contact. Maybe they don't want to talk to their state rep, but maybe they know someone who they think might.
We can get that. We can get all the information that anybody would ever want at offnow.org. That's kind of the virtual center of the OffNow campaign, and there's actually a tab there if you want to get involved. You can actually click that, and we'll find places for you to get involved in the movement. Essentially, what the OffNow campaign is, it's a transpartisan coalition of groups. It was primarily started by the 10th Amendment Center, That's the organization I work with. And then also the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, a great organization based out of D.C. that focuses on civil liberties issues, and a whole bunch of other organizations that have joined the coalition. Antiwar.com is on board, Downsize D.C., I can't even think of all of them. There's a whole bunch. And essentially what we're doing is exactly what we've talked about, state and local action to make it more difficult for the NSA to violate your rights. And the centerpiece of this is the Fourth Amendment Protection Act, which denies the material support to the NSA from any state entity. We're going to turn off their water. We're going to turn off their electricity. We're going to make sure that our public universities aren't being used as research facilities and recruiting grounds. And perhaps what I think is one of the most important parts of this is that it denies all of this info that's being shared around by the NSA to state and local law enforcement, makes it inadmissible in court.
Oh, man, and that's the most important point right there. Everybody just mull that one over. Remember about them laundering this information and rewriting how they came upon it, that kind of thing. Offnow.org. Thank you so much for your time, Michael.
Thanks for having me on, Scott.
That's Michael Meharry of the 10th Amendment Center, offnow.org. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our next guest today is Marjorie Cohn. She is now at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law at, the University of San Diego, is that it? She's formerly, of course, the president of the National Lawyers Guild. I'm sorry, did I botch the name of your university, Marjorie?
It's Thomas Jefferson School of Law.
Oh, okay.
It's an independent law school.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
So just drop the second part. Okay, good.
Right,
And you're the author of a brand new book coming out, a lot of books previously, but the brand new one is Drones and Targeted Killings, which, apropos to today's topic, first of all, thank you very much for joining us today. Sorry for the disjointed introduction there. I appreciate you coming on the show.
My pleasure, Scott.
Okay, and now, so yesterday, and they did this back last time around too, the government announced in advance that they are conspiring to murder an American citizen overseas somewhere. They handed the story. It seemed like a very top-down official leak, not a whistleblower-type disclosure, right? It was sort of an official government leak to Kimberly Dozier of the Associated Press. And they assert that there's an American citizen, member of Al-Qaeda, seemed like maybe they were referring to Pakistan, I don't know, and they don't know what to do about him, so they're going to kill him. Or at least they're looking at it, and it didn't seem like any of the questions they were looking at were whether they had the authority to do so or not, but just, whether it seemed right for, relations with the country we'll be bombing, et cetera, like that. I pretty much understand the story right, you think?
Well, I think, Scott, that according to the AP reports, they've been weighing the benefits of killing a U.S. citizen versus the possibility of a likely outcry internationally. So they're concerned with the politics of it. They're not concerned with the legality of it. Eric Holder has redefined due process to say that the Justice Department is going to provide the due process. Of course, that's the executive branch. The due process is provided by the judicial branch. That's the courts, and the courts are supposed to make a determination are supposed to approve things that like this. Due process means a notice of the charges against you and an opportunity to be heard. And yet they're circumventing this due process. Another interesting thing that the AP said is that according to a U.S. official, the Defense Department was divided over whether this man is dangerous enough to merit the potential domestic fallout of killing an American without charging him with a crime or trying him. You know, the Supreme Court said in the Hamdi case, Hamdi versus Rumsfeld, during the Bush administration, that if the president is going to keep a U.S. citizen as an enemy combatant, then that person has to be given due process. And that means arrested, charged with a crime, brought to trial, and given an opportunity to defend himself, not just taken out with a drone, which, by the way, usually kills innocent civilians along the way. So, it doesn't seem like anything much has changed since the hoopla and the outcry when Obama gave his speech last May about, you know, how we're really just going to kill the bad guys. We're going to be really careful about it. We're going to obey the law. And that was shortly after the leak of a white paper. And this was a leak. It wasn't intended to be public, where the white paper actually says that the government can kill a U.S. citizen who's not on the battlefield. If some high government official, not a judge, but some high government official thinks that the target is a senior al-Qaeda leader who poses an imminent threat of a violent attack against the United States. So how do they define imminent? Well, according to this white paper, the U.S. citizen can be killed even when there's no clear evidence that a specific attack on U.S. persons and interest will take place in the immediate future. So basically, we have this global battlefield where if there's someone anywhere who might be associated with al-Qaeda, according to a high government official, then Obama can authorize that he be taken out without any checks and balances, and this is illegal. The only time that armed force can be used against someone who's not on the battlefield is where there is an imminent threat. That means it's going to happen right away, that somebody is going to be attacking us. And, you know, the Obama administration justifies these drone attacks, which, by the way, Obama has used much more extensively than Bush ever did. The Obama administration, and Bush as well, says that these drone strikes are authorized under the Authorization for the Use of Military Force, the AUMF, that Congress passed a few days again after 9/11. But if you read the AUMF, it doesn't authorize this. The AUMF allows the president to use force only against groups and countries that had supported the 9/11 attacks. But when the Bush administration asked Congress at the time for open-ended military authority to deter and preempt any future acts of terrorism or aggression against the United States, Congress specifically rejected that open-ended military authority. So Congress has not authorized this. It's not clear whether Congress would authorize it. And during the debate last year about these drone strikes and targeted killing, members of Congress from both the Republican and the Democratic parties demanded that potential American targets be given a chance to surrender and mount a defense in U.S. courts instead of just being killed without a trial.
Well, let me ask you this. We've already seen the strikes, of course, on Alaki and his son, and the strike on Alaki also killed another American citizen, Khan. And then the son, there are various classified leaks, but the official ones that, that was some sort of accident, some kind of thing. But they, in any case, they have killed American citizens, and deliberately, certainly in the case of Alaki Sr. over there. But I wonder why you think that they don't go ahead and say, for example, why didn't they try him in absentia on a treason charge and go ahead, convict him and sentence him to death and then drone strike him? Because then at least they would have the pretense of the rule of law, where instead they're reduced to this argument that if the two different hemispheres of Obama's brain agree, or anyone he delegates the authority to, that amounts to due process of law.
Well, you know, they could have done that, and certainly they could have given him an opportunity to appear, either personally or through counsel. But, you know, the interesting thing is that the New York Times, and this is Today's New York Times. Today's New York Times says that of the four Americans that, you know, Obama has admitted killing with the drone strikes, including Awolaki, and this is from the New York Times, according to the White House, only Mr. Awolaki had been intentionally targeted. Well, you had three Americans who were killed in the drone attack that where Awolaki was targeted, and then 2 weeks later, his son, Awolaki's 16-year-old son, who had never been involved in any kind of terrorist group at all, was sitting at a cafe, an outdoor cafe, and was eating, I don't know if he was eating pizza, what he was eating, and another drone, American drone, targeted him and killed him. You know, this was not an accident, and the administration has never explained why they killed this child. But, you know, there's another thing that I think we need to talk about here, Scott, and that is that yesterday, Jeremy Scahill and Glenn Greenwald wrote a piece in The Intercept about the NSA's secret role in this assassination program.
Hold that thought just for a second, because I was hoping that you could answer why you think that they don't bother going through with any kind of rule of law procedure. Is it just sort of the David Addington attitude that they want to set the precedent that they can do whatever they want? Is that what Obama's up to here? Because, again, they could easily have convicted Awolaki in a court in Virginia. With or without
him. They may or may not have. They may or may not have. I mean, sometimes they don't have the evidence. You know, why didn't they arrest bin Laden and bring him to trial? I mean, I know everybody cheered how wonderful, you know, bin Laden was assassinated, but, you know, if Obama were going to stick to the rules that he set, not just for U.S. citizens, but for anybody in his May speech and in a fact sheet and a directive that he didn't release, it was classified, when the SEALs went in to bin Laden's compound, he wasn't armed. They could have captured him. They could have brought him back for trial. You know, keep in mind that, and this is important
if there's such a thing as an enemy combatant in the world, it was that guy. He's not an American-born citizen like Awolaki and his boy.
Well, you know what? Nobody deserves to be killed, taken out without due process. Due process under our Constitution protects everybody, not just U.S. citizens. And let me just tell you something. The answer to that argument that, well, bin Laden's a bad guy, we know he did it, let's just take him out. After World War II, after the Holocaust, where, you know, some of the absolute worst crimes in the history of man were committed by the Nazis, there was a dispute among the leaders of the victorious countries. And Winston Churchill said about what to do with the Nazi leaders. And Winston Churchill said, just take them out and shoot them. And Justice Robert Jackson, who was a U.S. Supreme Court justice on leave to be the chief U.S. prosecutor at Nuremberg, said, no, we can't do that. If we don't provide due process for these people, give them a fair trial, even these Nazis who have done these horrible things, then we will pass a poisoned chalice to future generations. And they were tried, and there's even some criticism about the trial that it wasn't fair enough, these Nuremberg tribunals. But some people were acquitted, some people were convicted, some people were actually put to death. So when you have the Nazis who committed genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity on a massive scale, and due process was good enough for them, then how do we get off saying that we're going to allow the president with no judicial or congressional oversight whatsoever to kill anybody he wants that he might suspect of being a bad guy? You know, he does these things called signature strikes where even if they don't have a name, even if they don't know who they're targeting, if people are present in the area where there are suspicious patterns of behavior, they're dropping bombs from drones on them and killing lots and lots of innocent people. And so I think it's important, yes, it's an outrage that they would do this to a U.S. citizen. It's also an outrage, and not only that, illegal, to do it to anybody. The United Nations Charter, which is a treaty the United States has ratified, it's part of U.S. law under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution, says that the only time you can use military force is in self-defense or when the Security Council approves it. Neither of those two things have happened here. Now, that doctrine has been expanded a bit to include protection against an imminent threat. But there's, you know, these people are sitting around, you know, they're sitting drinking coffee, you know, in their on their porch. They're not on the battlefield.
Right. I'm sorry, I got to interrupt you because we're going to have to go out and take this break real quick, but I hope that you can hang on through this short break, and then we can finish up, and then I'll let you. I'm sorry I interrupted you. I wanted to let you finish what you had to say about the new reporting of Scahill and Greenwald about the NSA and the drone program. Can you hang on with us?
Yes.
Okay, great. Everyone, it's Marjorie Cohen from the Thomas Jefferson School of Law, a former president of the National Lawyers Guild, and we will be right back after this. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with the author of the new book, Drones and Targeted Killings, Marjorie Cohen, professor of law at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law. What a great name for a school of law, right? All right. So thank you very much for holding on through the break there. Marjorie, and now I guess where were we? I know you know where you were.
Well, I think it's important for people to know that Jeremy Scahill and Glenn Greenwald exposed a very, very frightening practice yet in yesterday's edition of The Intercept, and that is the NSA's, the National Security Agency, who's been collecting all of our phone calls and emails, their secret role in the U.S. assassination program. Instead of using human intelligence, they're using electronic surveillance, so they're using cell phone tracking technology, and then killing people based on these cell phone locations. The problem is that, first of all, targets are increasingly aware that the NSA is relying on this geolocating, and they've moved to thwart that tactic. Other people are unaware their cell phone is being targeted. They lend their phone to friends, children, spouses, and family members. There's a top secret NSA document that was leaked by Edward Snowden that confirms that the NSA played a key supporting role in the drone strike that killed Awolaki. They also cite a recent study by a U.S. military advisor that during 1 year in Afghanistan, where the majority of drone strikes have taken place, that unmanned vehicles, drones, were 10 times more likely than conventional aircraft to cause civilian casualties. And another NSA document provided by Snowden says that by 2009, for the first time in the history of the U.S. Air Force, more pilots were trained to fly drones than conventional aircraft, mm-hmm. leading to a tipping point in U.S. military combat behavior, resorting to airstrikes in undeclared wars such as Yemen and Pakistan. So this is very disturbing because here we have two illegal, controversial, immoral policies of the Obama administration that seem to be helping each other, feeding each other, and that is the NSA surveillance program and the illegal assassination with drone strikes.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm sure you saw that last week, Associate Justice Antonin Scalia said that, hey, in times of war, the law falls silent. And in fact, he kind of mocked anyone who would be so naive as to think that we won't see, for example, another mass roundup of Americans, maybe based on their heritage, like what happened to the Japanese and some Germans, too, during World War II. And so what about that? What about, never mind exactly what the AUMF says, there's a war on, don't you know?
Well, you know, the Bush administration justified a lot of its illegal policies with this so-called war on terror. Now, that's a misnomer because terrorism is a tactic. It's not an enemy. You don't declare war on a tactic. And yet, under the guise of this war on terror, Bush and now Obama, although Obama doesn't use the words war on terror, he talks about war on al-Qaeda and other things, they're literally getting away with murder. You know, all of the people who who were killed and tortured during the Iraq war, which is, you know, never had to happen and has wreaked all kinds of havoc there. People are still suffering. The war in Afghanistan, which, you know, may never come to an end. Obama's going to wait until Karzai is no longer there so that he can keep American troops there in a supportive role, which basically means keep our footprint there so we can control things. And then Obama's policies. He has not closed Guantanamo. People are still being indefinitely detained. People are still being force-fed, who are on hunger strikes. Force-feeding constitutes torture, according to the UN Human Rights Commission. And the surveillance, overwhelming surveillance, that Edward Snowden has revealed of all of us, and this illegal assassination program taking people out all over the world, wherever they may be suspicious. You know, with no checks and balances, and it's very disturbing. And I think that people have to, and increasingly people are getting very upset about this. But it's important not just to be upset, but also to put pressure on those people who respond to pressure, which is your congresspersons, the White House. Email them, call them, demonstrate, send them letters, and make your feelings known. When you see a news article about this in a newspaper, write a letter to the editor. It's easy to do. You keep it under 150 words. You peg it to the article or to the op-ed. And even if yours doesn't get published, they count the number of letters on each side, and the ones they do publish reflect the balance of how many letters they receive. So even if your letter doesn't get published, it's going to help other letters to get published. So I think that it's really important not just to sit by and see, you know, all of these many, many hundreds of women and children who have been killed, wedding parties killed with these drones, and you know, the next thing is drones that aren't even operated at all, even remotely, that are totally computerized, so a computer decides who to target. You don't even have somebody sitting 6,000 miles away in Nevada with a joystick controlling the drones. So the technology is developing to such a point that, you know, George Orwell is probably turning over in his grave.
Yeah, well, hey, the computer says, and it has a lot more authority than me. I'm just a lowly drone operator, so hit the red button, right? The light's green. All right, well, and here's the other thing, too. You mentioned the war against the Nazis and the Imperial Japanese in World War II. America's involvement in that only lasted 3.5 years. And this is, of course, you know, as we can see with the wars in Somalia, Yemen, Pakistan, et cetera, and spreading on into Turkey, Lebanon, Syria, and everywhere else, that this is a self-perpetuating kind of thing. As Leon Panetta explained to David Gregory, the fact that we make more terrorists every time we kill a couple in Yemen, that we make many more than we killed, is tough because these are the tools we have, so we have to keep using them. And so they can just keep this going forever and ever and ever. So if the law really is silent, then they're really all bets are off.
The law is not silent, as I said, Scott. It's very clearly illegal what they're doing. And yes, it's not just illegal, immoral, but it's also backfiring, as you said. When people see their loved ones being killed with a drone, they hate the U.S. even more. They want to do the U.S. harm. And if you really want to stop terrorism, you don't, you know, decide to kill more and more and more people and torture them and keep them indefinitely in prisons like animals. You do a complete reassessment of U.S. foreign policy to see why people hate us so much, and it's not because of our democracy. It has nothing to do with that. It's because of our foreign policy. It's because of the fact that we have 800 bases all over the world with American soldiers. It's because Americans invade their countries and occupy their lands and support countries that mount illegal occupations and torture their people and commit war crimes. That's why. People hate us so much, and until there's a complete overhaul of U.S. foreign policy, we're going to be vulnerable to terrorism. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, one of the problems that we're up against, though, is, as we've seen with Obama, the temptation of any leader, even, say, for example, if it was Ron Paul's son, Mr. Constitution, who voted no on everything always, well, except the AUMF, unfortunately, but if his son was the president, I would expect him to act just like Obama and say, well, this is just too much power to give up. How could anyone really roll it back if they're the one in the chair? Allow it to be rolled back.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know what he would do. I don't know what anybody would do. I know that he, Rand Paul, although I don't favor most of his policies, has been very critical of U.S. foreign policy and the reliance on militarism. Hillary Clinton, who seems to be the front runner for the Democratic nomination and could probably have it if she wanted it, is really even more of a hawk than Obama. When she was a candidate, she said, we are going to, quote, obliterate Iran, unquote. Obliterate Iran. Can you imagine a leader of this country saying we're going to obliterate an entire country? And there was nothing she did as Secretary of State, or very little as Secretary of State, and before that as a U.S. Senator, that looked at other solutions before military ones. She really walked pretty much in lockstep with the with Obama and with the neocons. So I don't see any major improvement if Hillary Clinton is elected president. I know a lot of people who support her, but I don't think that she would do much different than Obama is doing right now. I don't know what Rand Paul would do. It's very hard to say.
That it sure is a lot of power to be the commander in chief of this military, and especially even during just a pseudo war, not a real one, a Cold War would do, right? Like the Cold War with Iran. Let me ask you this real quick before the end of the show, if I could, Marjorie. What do you know about any progress toward getting the 6,000-page torture report of the Senate Intelligence Committee released, or at least significant portions of it that we can look at?
Well, I know that many people in Congress have been clamoring to see that report, and yet it remains classified. I don't know. Maybe there's a whistleblower who will publicize that information, but they seem to be keeping it held pretty tightly under lock and key. So I don't know. I mean, Obama talks about transparency, and he has one of the most secret administrations really in the history of the country. So I don't think we're going to be seeing that report anytime soon.
I wonder if they're afraid that if the people saw what was really in there, that would lead to prosecutions. The game would be up at that point, you think?
Well, they're afraid of something. They're afraid of something. If they really had confidence that everything they did was legal, and if they don't intend to do it again, in other words, torture, then what are they hiding? What do they have to fear?
Right. Well, we just have to learn to respect their privacy, I guess.
No, not if they are acting in our name with our resources and putting us at risk. No, you can't just say that they have the right to be secret and private. I don't buy that.
Oh, no. I was just playing, of course. All right. Thank you so much for your time. You stayed over time. I really appreciate it, Marjorie.
Nope. No problem, Scott. Take care.
All right, everybody. That is the great Marjorie Cohen. Formerly, she is the was the president of the National Lawyers Guild. She's now a professor at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego, and she's got a brand new book coming out, Drones and Targeted Killings, which promises, as you just heard, to be absolutely great. All right, so that's it for the show, everybody. Thanks very much for listening. I'll be back here tomorrow from 3 to 5 Eastern Time on the Liberty Express, and if you're on the Eastern Seaboard, why not head to D.C., and I'll see you Saturday at the International Students for Liberty Conference. At the FFF Conference Within a Conference. There, John Glaser and I are giving a talk on libertarianism versus the empire. It'd be nice to see you. All right. Take it easy. Talk at you tomorrow.